This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When W.S. Merwin handed over his poet laureate wreath to Philip Levine, Merwin returned to his solar-powered house and lush gardens on the island of Maui. W.S. Merwin is known to live a quiet life. He has said that when he's in the city, he misses the country all of the time, and when he's in the country, he misses the city some of the time. So he lives in the country and visits the city. As a poet, Merwin is revered for the quiet majesty of his language, his attention to the natural world, and the music of his punctuation-free form. W.S. Merwin has authored more than 36 books. He has won every award an American poet and translator can win, including the Pulitzer Prize twice, and he balances his quiet life with regular public appearances. On Monday, October 17th, he will read at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. W.S. Merwin joins me now by phone from his home in Hawaii. Welcome to the State of Things.
I'm happy to be here.
You have been writing and publishing for close to 70 years now. Your successor as poet laureate is a contemporary of yours, Philip Levine. Do you feel like there's a particular flowering that poets experience later in life?
I think there should be. You know, there's a psychologist, psychiatrist, philosopher whom I admire enormously, James Hillman, and his most recent book, The Force of Character, is about just that. There's been some wonderful writing on the subject, and basically Hillman says almost everything that has been written about age you just have to throw out. He said it's just saying all the things you can't do when you get older, and he said we all know that. That's so obvious that it doesn't need to be said. The fact is that there are certain things that you can do, because the force of character, if there was any, is maturing and matured, and it's shelled off all sorts of things it never needed anyway. And some of the basic things that it works with, it's always had. And that's one of them is its own character. I mean, we have this romantic idea that everything's written by the time that Keats and Shelley died, unfortunately. I mean, we keep thinking of what they could have been. We're so lucky to have them the way they are. There's a wonderful poem of Borges toward the end of his life, when he'd gone blind, and he'd always known he was going to go blind. But it's called In Praise of Darkness, and it's a most, most beautiful poem. And it's partly about not seeing, and so seeing everything as you did as a young man, and about age, and it is absolutely beautiful.
Do you think that flowering comes from a kind of fearlessness? There's sort of nothing to lose, so we can look back and contextualize, see our lives, and be more honest about our experience? Or is there something really new about the way we experience our lives when we get older?
Of course, it is new. Every morning it's new. But it's always been there, too, because if we are able to face it, death and life are inseparable. I mean, death is not something that happens in a linear way at the end of everything. It's something that is there at every moment of our lives. I mean, each day dies in sleep, is you know, it says in the poem. If that bothers us, I mean, but also everything is born again in the poem. It's all in the same moment.
But that suggests that as we get older, we have to lose our fear and come to that mature understanding about our death being part of life, rather than grow ever more fearful that we're one day closer.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I was given a great gift by my mother, who was utterly fearless about death all her life, and made it very clear. And the other things that she told me that I was not afraid of, and when I thought about what she said, I realized she was right. You know, she was, on the face of it, basically, she started out rather timid because of a terrible background and upbringing. And by the end of her life, she was thinking for herself completely, and speaking for herself, and she got it right, but she'd never been afraid of dying.
You know, it's interesting because that is the stuff of great religions. Your father was a Presbyterian minister.
Yes.
You grew up in the church, and you're speaking, it sounds to me, great spiritual truths, and yet you have, when it comes to religion per se, that's something that you have thrown off.
Well, I'm off institutions altogether. And institutionalizing religion, that dimension to our lives, which I don't doubt for a minute, but institutionalizing it is something that I came very early to avoid. I mean, by the time I was in college, I wanted nothing to do with the organizational. I don't scorn people who need it, but it gets in the way.
Why do we do that? Why do you suppose we take these and
anxiety, the feeling that unless it's got a shape and a handle, it's not real, when in fact it doesn't have a shape and a handle. And again and again, in all the great traditions, it's telling you that. You know, it's there in Judaism and in Christianity, and it's certainly there in the Eastern religions, that what you're talking about finally is something that can't be put into words. And you have to be able to step off the 100-foot pole and see that really it's okay, you know. And I think this is one of the great links between that dimension, and I don't say religion because that immediately invokes the idea of organization, but I mean the religious dimension to our life, the world, which is not the thing, which is not organized and is not something you can pick up and hold and buy and sell. It's where everything of value in our lives comes from, everybody's lives. But it's certainly there where all the arts come from.
This well of unknowing, our in a sense our ignorance, what we don't know or don't know yet.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a great deal of it has to do with how we feel about the unknown, what we don't know.
Well,
and if that makes us very uneasy, as it does, and as our whole society encourages us to feel uneasy about not knowing. And, you know, ever since the beginning of modern science and positivist thinking in the 19th century, the idea is that we really are basically rational creatures, and that there's a lot we don't know, but we will soon get to where we know everything.
And we have this problem because we've put in the driver's seat that thing which tells stories and knows stuff, and we really don't want to hear from that side of us that has taken in a whole lot of information and tells us things without a form.
Well, telling stories is a little bit different, but I mean, telling stories instead of being able to see it is something else. My stepson John Burnham Schwartz is a wonderful novelist, and he gave a marvelous talk a couple of months ago at Sun Valley about fiction and the value of fiction. And I talked to him afterwards, and I said, John, you know, you started it and ended it in started too late, because you really started in the 19th century, and it didn't start in the 19th century. You should go back and read The Odyssey, which is all about that, and where Homer's Ulysses, and this is the imagination, of course, you know, escaping all of these institutions, all of these. Situations that are binding. The Odysseus, from the moment he starts home to Ithaca, can't ever tell the truth about himself. And he tells these incredible stories wherever he goes, whoever anybody asks about him, he tells a different story, including telling the giant that he's no man, you know. And the giant asks who he is, and he says, I'm no man. And then he gets to Ithaca. He gets home. After 20 years, this is the place where he was born, grew up, married, had a wife and a son, and the whole life before they got him and got him into the war, and which he tried to dodge by pretending to be a woman. He can't tell the truth. The one thing he can't do is let anybody know who he is. And so until he finds some real allies and finds his son, he can't let anybody know who he is. So that's the great final irony of the whole thing. But is it total lies, or is it a kind of imaginative projection of the world and the infinite number of shapes that we have that are there? As life and death are both there in every moment of our lives, we're not simple creatures at any moment in our lives. There's no such thing as pure feelings. Our feelings are always mixed.
So getting back to Odysseus again, the idea that perhaps he's not lying, these are simply responses to unseen worlds that aren't on the surface, that Homer gives us a
lying.
Surface word, but there are other...
He's dealing with the whole situation, too.
Yeah.
Both are true at once.
Yeah. I'd love to hear a poem right now, and because you're on the phone and it wouldn't do justice to either your voice or the quality of your poetry, if with your permission, we're going to play a recording of you reading a poem.
Oh, that's fine.
Would that be all right?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Well, we're going to read one, play one from your collection, The Shadow of Sirius, and the poem is called Rainlight.
All day the stars watch from long ago. My mother said, I am going now. When you are alone, you will be all right. Whether or not you know, you will know. Look at the old house in the dawn rain. All the flowers are forms of water. The sun reminds them through a white cloud, touches the patchwork spread on the hill, the washed colors of the afterlife that lived there long before you were born. See how they wake without a question, even though the whole world is burning.
W.S. Merwin reading his poem Rainlight from the collection Shadow of Sirius. He will be at NC State on October 17th at 7:30 at Tally Hall at the Tally Student Center. He is with us now on the phone. It seems to me that that poem embodies much of what we've just talked about.
I think so. I was thinking about it as I heard a distant me reading it.
But what do you think about that? What is it like for you to hear yourself read?
I never do it normally unless I have to. But it didn't sound so bad. It sounded rather far away, but that may be because I'm hearing it, at several removes in the studio. It probably sounded clearer to you.
It sounded great. I mean, that line, whether or not you know, you will know. The idea that some part of us is absorbing the truth, even though it may not be on the surface.
I think that's true. The quality of the in us which is unknown and which is at home with the unknown is a part of us that if we're uneasy about it, we're losing. The most valuable thing we have. I think everything that's of value comes out of the unknown. And after all, we don't remember being born, and we won't remember dying. The ends of our life are unknown to us and always will be. And it's how we feel if we're at ease with that. We realize, well, we don't really know anything about birth and death either. We know the physical aspects of it, the mechanical aspects and all of that, which God knows is important. It won't work without it. But there's something else that we don't know, and if we turn our face away, we're never going to know. So it's not going to be that. It's not going to be something new that we learn.
But there's a sense in the body of your work that there was a time when humankind may have been more familiar. I'm thinking of your poem, Green Fields, that I have in front of me here.
Yeah.
And by this part of the century, it reads, few are left who believe in the animals, for they are not there in the carved parts of them served on plates and the pleas from slatted trucks.
Yes.
Are we forgetting? Are we forgetting something that we once knew? Are we in contact with something that was more important to us?
I think so. 9 years ago, 7 years ago, when we were away, when we were in Europe, the dog, whom I loved just, you know, helplessly, wonderful dog, and very, very close companion, died. And I was so, we were both absolutely shattered by the news, and we couldn't get home. There was nothing we could do. And we were in France, and the only thing that made sense to me, that was some, made any sense at all, was to revisit, go to the new caves and revisit all the old ones in that area, which was, we stay very close to where the Paleolithic caves are, and Lascaux and all the others. There are new ones discovered all the time, and I've loved them for most all my life. But each time I see them, I see something new about them. And I've read a lot about them, and I realized some years ago that the experts who were talking about them don't know any more about them than I do. Most of it is speculation. And the poet's intuition or notion about them is probably about as worth about as much as theirs is. And I've got a notion about the caves, but I mean...
Well, tell us about it. Give us...
The animals not being separate from us. I think the animals, I think the whole... But the feeling is, you know, it's a vision quest that those men were, those people, we don't know, probably both sexes, were going on. Finally, there wasn't possibly enough light to do for them, enough nor enough to drink or enough to eat. There was great risk of not coming out again. It doesn't look like much distance to us with electric lights, but I mean, you know, a half mile in down one of those tunnels is an enormous distance in the dark. And it's not art. Because, I mean, the great halls were art for initiation ceremonies, but the tunnels and the art in the tunnels was nothing to do with art. And there were many times there were these wonderful carvings 25 feet up in a tiny cleft that you could barely get up into. They're not to be shown to anybody. There's something there that somebody felt in the dark, in the stone, that had to do with what was part of their lives and their link with the animals. And I think what the animals represented, I mean, one thing they may have represented to them, the animals were the elders. These were migrant animals, almost all of them. And they knew the way, whereas the humans, both the Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, were relatively recent creatures who must have felt that they had to keep moving, but they didn't know the way. There was a great deal that they did not know, and that their elders knew it, and there was a contact with them. And, of course, the elders, too, were themselves. And I think that's what's going on in the caves. It's that contact with that part of themselves. So they come out feeling they know something. Hmm. They know something that they didn't know when they went in there.
W.S. Merwin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
W.S. Merwin is an award-winning poet, playwright, and translator. He won the Pulitzer Prize twice, most recently in 2009 for The Shadow of Sirius. He reads at NC State on Monday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. in Talley Student Center. For more information, go to news.ncsu.edu. Coming up on the program, the untold story of Umstead State Park. Stay with us on The State of Things.